Hi, this is Joe Francica, and welcome to another Directions Media podcast. Today I will be speaking with Joel Campbell, the president of ERDAS. Joel was appointed president in December 2009, but is an industry veteran of over 20 years and has held positions with GOI, Definiens, Earth Data, and Esri. We talked about several things related to crisis mapping and the efforts by ERDAS in Haiti, as well as what we can expect in the future about image processing over the internet. I hope you'll enjoy the conversation. Stay tuned.
Well, Joel, thanks very much for taking the time to join me today, and we'll talk about a couple of topics related to the remote sensing industry and what you see. You've obviously been around the business for quite a long time, and I'd like to start by having maybe review some of the efforts that you did with regard to the Haitian and Chilean earthquakes and what support services were provided by ERDAS. We didn't hear a lot about that, but obviously things were going around in the background by a lot of geospatial companies, and your efforts were probably very much needed. So I'm kind of curious to hear what you did for that effort.
Sure. First of all, Joe, thanks a lot for having me today. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. To talk sort of specifically about our efforts in Haiti and Chile following the earthquakes in those areas, we sort of realized very quickly that there would be a large influx of people trying to respond to the events, both from a humanitarian perspective as well as from an ongoing sort of cleanup and management perspective and an understanding of the devastation. So we chose immediately to stand up one of our Apollo servers in a public space and to begin accumulating data as quickly as we could get it and making it available in sort of open standard ways so that anyone who was working in that area in the relief efforts could have access to the most up-to-date data, no matter what product they were using, MapInfo, ArcMap, AutoCAD, et cetera. We got imagery sort of provided to us by Digital Globe, by GOI. We also got the Google imagery that they were capturing from various sources, NOAA imagery from the planes that they were using to fly the area in Haiti specifically, stuff from the World Bank. Wherever we could find data that was freely unencumbered and easily distributed to a broad audience, we sort of took that data and put it up online. In the end, we had about 1.5 terabytes of data that was available on WMS services. I don't know how these statistics are probably about 2 or 3 weeks old, but we've had close to 200,000 hits or uses of the WMS services that we've provided on Haiti specifically. Obviously, not long later, we had the same effect in Chile. In Chile, we were able to stand up data within hours of the earthquake, thanks to some time zones. I was in London when the earthquake struck, so I was able to call one of our staff in Hawaii, and we took advantage of time zones, and literally within hours we had a system stood up that had whatever data we had available to us, which was primarily from the USGS. Over time we added more data. There's now sort of probably on the order of 50 gigabytes or so of data on the Chile site. We've had on the order of 30,000 to 40,000 hits and uses of that service. Obviously, there's a much different dynamic in Chile than there is in Haiti with a more mature government infrastructure to support an event like that, as well as the sort of proximity and involvement of folks in the U.S. to Haiti, which was different to Chile.
One of the things that I noticed about this whole crisis mapping effort was, again, unprecedented support by a lot of different mapping agencies, solution providers like yourself. What do you think are the best practices we can take away from this? Because it's obviously going to happen again. You know, it happened over a year and a half ago in China. We're going to see these types of natural disasters come about us again. But from the perspective of the geospatial community, we have to develop some sort of best practice. I'd be curious as to what you found was good, the bad, and the ugly about getting something stood up this quickly.
Yeah, great question, because there is definitely good, bad, and ugly. I think the good is that we've reached a place in the industry where the technologies are very interoperable. So our ability to stick data up and publish it in OGC standard ways and allow that to be consumed by whatever client application someone might choose to use to do their job, I think is one of the really good things. One of the really bad things is that there's still an enormous amount of bureaucracy in the United States in sort of data rights, how data can be shared. So, you know, in some cases, it's very easy because people recognize that policies be damned, we're going to do what we know is the right thing to do. In other cases, people want to stand on policy and say, well, we don't have a, you know, a memorandum of understanding or a data sharing agreement. And the time it takes to execute those types of things in a crisis is definitely the bad. The ugly, you know, I'm not sure what I would call ugly. I think one of the challenges that's sort of a little bit ugly on the surface maybe is really having a defined way to understand the authentic data and the sort of authoritative data and its accuracy and its currency and all of the things that are important to people, and making that sort of abundantly clear to users who are coming to the site so that they understand the risk reward of using particular sets of data. I think a lot about, you know, online shopping sites where people say you buy a pair of pants and the online shopping site says you may be also interested in this belt because right. It's related to the pants. And somehow in the geospatial world where someone says, you know, I'm trying to do a slope analysis, and there's almost this recommender that says, well, these would be the appropriate data sets for that. And it's done the hard work of understanding which ones are most accurate, which ones are most current, and which ones come from an authoritative source.
Right. And I think you're alluding to, and correct me if I'm wrong, OpenStreetMap, which I think became more or less the definitive baseline map because of the fact that it was done so quickly and there was so much contributed data. And yet there was perhaps very little thought given to the fact that this may not be the best data, but it was certainly the only data for some period of time. And you're coming from a perspective of using remotely sensed data, which is more or less the absolute ground truth, as good as you can get it without actually standing on the ground. So what's your perspective on what happened in the process of going from something that was maybe not let's just say, not necessarily questionable, but the best you could have, going towards something that maybe is a little bit better?
There's definitely this notion that, you know, you'll take what you can get when you're in a crisis mode, and if that is, you know, less than 100% accurate or 100% up to date, it's better than nothing at all, and then you will evolve it over time. But I think what it really does is it highlights the real extreme importance of imagery from all sources, whether that's satellite imagery or airborne imagery or terrestrially captured mobile mapping imagery, the importance of those in sort of driving the updates to geospatial databases. Because as you say, they are the, you know, the closest thing we can get to ground truth without standing there. And if we can understand their currency, then we can understand that we've got the best data available to us, and we can visualize it and we can analyze it in a way that we get the most accurate, authoritative source of data that there is. And I think it just really puts imagery into the spotlight. Now, there is a downside to that, of course, you know, that any image taken 13 minutes before the earthquake was clearly out of date. Right? So if you had yesterday's imagery, as soon as the earthquake happened, it's irrelevant because now the whole situation on the ground has changed. But post sort of event, the best chance we have to sort of really fully understand the context is, you know, by looking at remotely sensed data, whether it's airborne or spaceborne.
That's a good place to perhaps ask you about what I would call the consumerization of remotely sensed data. It's more or less everywhere these days, perhaps by Google entering the market and putting up something like the Google Earth, that people became more enamored with the data. But there's, you know, again, also a good side and a downside to that. Certainly expectations are raised. it certainly has highlighted the fact that we're more aware of looking at data from a top-down kind of a view, and it goes directly towards this accuracy and the reliability of information. And my question is kind of straddling both what happened in Haiti and what we see in the consumer side, which is there are certain expectations that the data that we derive is very accurate, always very accurate. And that puts us as professionals kind of in a strange position. And I was wondering if you have any thoughts on that same topic.
Well, I think, interestingly, Joe, if we think back sort of 10 or 15 years in the market space, there were lots of people, for example, who built geospatial systems to do routing and delivery, whether those were furniture companies or those were appliance manufacturers or deliverers, you know, whatever they might be, big box stores. But they built sort of highly sophisticated geospatial systems, you know, captured data, managed the data, and then had sort of routing algorithms to deliver stuff. And those were very effective systems. Today, we all, at the consumer level, rely on personal navigation devices that we buy for $150 that come preloaded with data, or we rely on a Google Maps or a MapQuest or a Bing Maps to do our point-to-point directions and our routing. And for, you know, a large part of our lives, these are very efficient tools. But one of the things that I've noticed is that big box stores now, or maybe little box stores, however you want to call them, instead of relying on a system that they've built themselves and they control and manage, they choose to use these sort of consumer-level personal navigation devices or MapQuest-type things and use those in support of their business. And guess what? I moved to Atlanta, and my street, which is 2.5 years old, doesn't exist on any of them.
Right.
So when I want furniture delivered, they can't find my house. And I think this is the challenge that we face in the industry. While the Googles and the Microsofts of the world have really raised the awareness, they've raised the awareness of the value of geospatial data and geospatial thinking. There hasn't been a parallel raising of the understanding of what geospatial data and analysis is really all about. And I think that's where folks in our industry need to continue to pay attention and drive, because at the end of the day, our customers, our professionals in the geospatial industry, are the ones who are working for my local county, who incidentally does have my street well articulated in their GIS. But how does it find its way from their work to this consumer level thing that people are more and more dependent upon? I spoke to someone this morning who was in my office, and they were telling me about an intersection up in Northern Virginia, and they looked on the imagery of it, and the imagery was a minimum 3 years old.
Right.
You know, whole new shopping centers and complexes that don't exist on the imagery on Google or Microsoft. So the challenge of sort of how we get the changing data that we're capturing every day with remote sensing technologies, and how we get that moved through into the consumer level portals that everybody is quite fascinated with, and which incidentally are very useful.
Right. And what I see happening is that eventually somebody is going to step in and say, you know, we do really want this accurate data. We want more timely updates. And maybe it'll start with the media. They want to zoom into downtown Nashville, which is now flooded. But if you looked on Google Earth, you wouldn't see flooding, right? You want
right.
that up-to-date imagery. And maybe eventually somebody's going to demand it and bring it down in a more rapid fashion. And I've often had this question asked, which is, how quick are we to real-time remotely sense data? And maybe you have a thought on that, whether we're going to launch microsatellites or whatnot. Eventually, or obviously somebody like Erdos is going to process that information. But we're not there yet in terms of real-time remotely sense data. And I'm just kind of curious, do you see that coming, or do you think that's a possibility in the near term?
I think it's a reality today in the defense and intelligence space around the world that there is persistent surveillance with geographically referenced, inertially measured video feeds in war zones that are capturing data in real time and you know, doing analysis against it. Will it translate over into a more mainstream sort of consumer level or geospatial community level thing? I actually think so. I think this notion of persistent surveillance, whether it's from a constellation of small satellites or whether it's from a blimp or some other type of airborne drone that's capturing data on a continuous basis, I do think we will find a place where real-time or near real-time data is available from remote sensing technologies. Now, will that be universal across every square inch of the planet? Highly doubtful. But will that be an added benefit to the network of video cameras currently in place in London, England, for example? I think absolutely we'll begin to see persistent surveillance in those sort of major metropolitan areas that are watching everything. Think about the attempted car bombing in Times Square just over the weekend. And had there been airborne persistent surveillance, the forensics work of tracking back that vehicle and where it came from and who got out of it, and all of those things would have been much easier to do had that technology been in place. So I think there are some benefits and value in it in everyday life that will drive us in that direction over the coming years. The technologies are getting better. Computers are getting faster to store it and manage it and analyze it. Privacy issues are being dealt with. So I think all of those things are lining up so that, yes, you know, my view is that it will definitely be something we will be dealing with over the coming years. And it is something at ERDOS, for example, that we're already dealing with in the defense and intelligence space around the world.
And that also brings up an interesting situation, which is how does ERDAS take advantage of bringing image processing closer to, for lack of a better word, a non-professional user? Will we be able to do image processing over the net? So how are you going to take advantage of that, and maybe what do you think is going to happen in terms of maybe lightweight image processing?
Great question. We are already doing that at ERDOS. We are sort of on the leading edge of this thing called web processing services, which is an emerging OGC standard for how you do geospatial processing analysis over a web in real time, on demand, in sort of a standardized way. And that capability exists in our products today. One can author a spatial modeling process in our Imagine product. They can publish that as a WPS service, which can be managed and exposed by our Apollo product family. So we're already there. It is very early in that cycle, but I think it's going to continue to grow. Having said that, there's some significant challenges. So if I have an interest in doing, for example, a viewshed analysis on a particular piece of geography, there could be 7 or 8 different, you know, algorithms from different vendors or different web processing services that could provide that viewshed. But I somehow need to know what it is they want and you know, how I need to hand it to them. And there needs to be some consistency across the board so that if I'm doing a viewshed, I know I need a elevation input and I need a land use land class input and you know, whatever else I might need, and that I am also going to get an output and then what parameters I want to set, et cetera. So I think the sort of technical approach is there and we have implemented it. I think the practical approach on how you really make that interoperable against multiple vendors, multiple data types, multiple systems is work that we still need to do in the industry.
And that kind of circles us back to the question on what happened in Haiti and Chile, which is having this interoperable situation where we can collaborate very, very quickly and ingest as much information as possible. So that seems to be coming, and it seems like you're in a good position to handle that.
We think we are. You know, we certainly are making investments in those areas and trying to stay ahead of that curve and understand where the market is going. I think things like cloud computing, which give us great new opportunities to not only sort of host these things and make them available, they give us opportunities to scale them when we need to process stuff quickly and we need lots of processing power, but we only need it for a little while. They give us opportunities for new business models where we can offer software as a service or processing as a service instead of having someone have to go off and buy and learn how to use a desktop software package. So I think that the technologies are evolving in the geospatial frame. The technologies are evolving in the sort of mainstream information technology frame. The data is evolving in the remote sensing sphere. And all of these things, I do believe, are coming together to make it pretty interesting times.
Well, Joe, great. Thanks. Thanks very much. It's been a great conversation. I really enjoyed catching up with you. And we'll catch up again sometime very soon, I hope.
Great. Thanks a lot, Joe. I enjoyed it as well, and we really appreciate having the chance to talk to you.
Thanks for joining us today on Another Directions Media Podcast. If you'd like to comment about today's interview, you could write to us at editors@directionsmag.com. Thanks again, and be sure to tell a friend.